they said use federal taxable income as our reference point since 1987.
Deduction example a little bit further. The maximum amount there we heard was $4,000, but the average tax benefit was $165. That has to do with what Minnesota's tax rates are. So if your taxable income, for instance, were $50,000 before that tuition deduction, then you got to take $4,000 off of it. Now you're only paying tax on $46,000. And we apply our three income tax rates to that, and you end up with a benefit on average of the $165. A credit is different from a deduction in that it acts to directly reduce your tax. So if you have a $4,000 credit, which would be a very generous credit, that would reduce your actual tax liability by $4,000. That's the difference between a credit and a deduction.
Ms. Manzi, can I interrupt? Can you explain refundable and non-refundable credits, just briefly for members to just hear it once, and we'll go back to it as we work through bills this year, but there, I apologize. Okay, you've got it in there. We'll get to it later.
Yeah, I could skip ahead to it if you'd like.
That's fine. I think since we're on credits, just having members understand the difference.
Okay, so continuing on with that extremely large $4,000 credit that I just created, if it were a non-refundable credit, then you would only be able to use that credit to offset your actual tax liability. So if your tax liability at the state level were, for example, $2,000, you would get to use $2,000 of your $4,000 credit to reduce your liability to zero, and the other $2,000 would not be of any benefit to you. If it were, however, a refundable credit, then the state refunds the balance of it to you, so you actually benefit from the full amount. So in this example, you would use the first $2,000 of your credit to reduce your liability to zero, and then you would get a check from the state for the remaining $2,000 as a tax refund. And we have currently five refundable credits, and I'll be talking about them a little bit later, but I'm going to back up to talk a little bit more about deductions first.
Thank you.
Okay, continuing with deductions, we start at the top of the Minnesota income tax form with federal taxable income, and then there are a handful of deductions that we're required to make by federal law. These are items that the federal government prohibits the states from imposing their income taxes on, and they are U.S. bond interest, railroad retirement benefits, which are an analog of Social Security for railroad workers, and the on-reservation earnings of members of Indian tribes. Following those, we have a number of deductions that Minnesota has chosen to make at the state level. We allow a deduction for K-12 education expenses, and the deduction for K-12 education expenses does include private school tuition for grades K through 12. We allow a deduction for charitable contributions made by people who claim the standard deduction at the federal level, so they aren't eligible to claim the federal itemized deduction for charitable contributions. But we allow them to claim a deduction at the state level for 50% of charitable contributions they make that are over $500. We also allow a subtraction for low-income elderly filers, and that is typically claimed by people who, for one reason or another, are not in the Social Security system. So this is analogous to the portion of Social Security income that's exempt from tax. We allow a subtraction for active service military pay. This includes pay that's earned when you're deployed somewhere out of the state, and also pay that's earned when you're called to active service in the state. It does not include drill pay for a member of the reserve or National Guard's weekend of training and 2 weeks of training in the summer. As an example that hits close to home, back after September 11th, we had a number of National Guard members called to active service at the airport to provide security. This subtraction, I don't believe, was in place at the time, but if it had been, they would have been allowed to deduct their pay for that active service, because that active service was not part of their regular training. It was actual active service. And then we have a subtraction for organ donation expenses, which are the first $10,000 of expenses, including lost wages, that a person incurs when they decide to become an organ donor. So we take all those deductions off at the state level, and we have also a small number of additions at the state level, and then we arrive at what we call Minnesota taxable income. And we have a three-rate system. This is where the progressivity, one of the places the progressivity comes from in our income tax. The other place the progressivity comes from in our income tax is that we follow the federal standard deduction and personal exemptions. So people with very low incomes aren't really in the tax system at all because they don't have any taxable income. They have some income, but none of it is subject to tax. The standard deduction for married couples is right around $10,000. The personal and dependent exemption is close to $4,000. So if you're a married couple with two kids, you don't have any income tax liability at all until your income is over $20,000. If you have more income than that, then you get to contribute to Minnesota's income tax. And our first rate is 5.35%, and for married couples, that applies on the first $31,150 of taxable income in 07. Our middle rate is 7.05%, and then our top rate on incomes over about $120,000 is 7.85%. And the brackets for these rates are indexed each year for inflation, and there are lower brackets in place for single filers, and then there are brackets that are in between the two for head of household filers. We talked about the two types of credit.
Ms. Manzi?
Yes.
Excuse me. Representative Rugavina.
Nina, what is the cost now in today's dollars for the 2099 income tax cuts? You know what it is, Oprah?
I'm afraid I don't know that. I can find that out for you, but I don't know the number for that.
See if you could get that.
Ms. Manzi?
No, I'll fix that.
Ms. Manzi, yes, if you could provide that information to the committee.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll get that information to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Rukavina. Other questions? Representative Broad.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Rukavina, you indicated the cost to the state, and I guess I look at it as a little bit differently as a reduction to the taxpayer.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Rukavina.
Representative Broad. You know, when you get 55, the richest 55 Minnesotans, $10 million back a year, or almost $11 million, when their adjusted gross income after their attorneys hide all their money is $1.7 billion. Shame on you.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, a lot of the small business owners in the state happen to run their system through and then put the money back into the business in the creation of jobs, and I think that's a good thing.
Representative Rubin,
I don't recall speaking on that issue at all right now. I'm talking about 55 richest Minnesotans whose adjusted gross income is $1.7 billion, getting $11 million back a year, the 55 of them. They probably don't even know they got it back.
Representative Rod?
I think they were
happy. No, and members, it feels good to be back in the tax committee, doesn't it? That was a great exchange, and
Representative. Sure, she can, you know, defend that later on this year, I'm sure.
And we'll go to Representative Demmer in just a minute here. Members, you know, this is the dissent we like, and this is what we're here for, and I think it is appropriate that we feel free to jump in on your thoughts as we move through these tax systems. This is just a prelude to the debate. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rukavina seems to have a lot of information. If they're getting if those 55 people are getting a cut of 11, how much are they paying, Representative Rukavina?
I think they're paying probably.
Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, they're probably paying 7.35% of their income on after all their deductions. But the point being, Representative Demmer, if you want to have a debate about fairness in taxes, let's start talking about that after they made $94,000, they stopped paying Social Security tax. And almost everyone sitting at this table has paid 6.5% of their income right off the top to the federal government. Now, it would be one thing to say, well, you know, they don't get the advantage of Social Security, but Social Security is paying for my neighbor's kid down the street, paying for my other neighbor who's got polymyalgia. And why should I have to pay 6.5% of my income when those 55 richest Minnesotans aren't even paying 0.1% to take care of those people? You want to talk about the war now and the trust fund from the Social Security financing the war? I'll bet you those 55 people are making a lot of money off the war. But most Americans and Minnesotans aren't making any money off the war. They're sacrificing because of it. But they're paying 6.5% of their income. When you figure all this stuff in, you talk about progressivity and regressivity. It's a really good deal to be a wealthy, wealthy Minnesotan and a wealthy, wealthy American right now. But it isn't a good deal to be a middle-income American or a middle-income Minnesotan. And that's my point.
Representative Zimmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Rukavina, when we get to the point of talking federal tax law in this committee, then I guess we can debate those issues with Social Security and the war and all that kind of stuff. In terms of Minnesota tax, I think the 55 people you're talking about probably are in the 1% that are paying over 20% of the total tax revenues in the entire state.
Mm-hmm.
And probably a good share of the tax, the job providers also.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair and Mr. Zimmer, they're probably making 30% of the income in the state and only paying 20% of the tax. There's where the discrepancy lies.
We're going to go to Representative DeForest next, but I just want to caution Representative Demmer as a new member of the committee. You know, Representative Rukavina has this filing system that when you're wondering if he's got the facts, it's right here. So you will see that suit coat open and the papers come out, and get ready, because we know Representative Rukavina's filing system, and it is something to be reckoned with.
Well, thank you, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I kind of gathered that. That's why I asked him the question rather than Ms. Mancy.
He actually
didn't answer my question, but we got the flavor of it.
Thank you, Representative DeForest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one question for Representative Rukavina. Where does Carl Polad fall on the list of 55?
Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, Mr. DeForest, I don't know that, because when I asked Ms. Manzi to get that information with me, they kept giving me different numbers every year. I asked for 50, and they gave me 57 one year and 55 the next, so I couldn't figure out if you were in the top 50, Representative DeForest.
Representative Ms. Manzi, before we go to Representative Broad, I think Ms. Manzi, I think it's instructive to understand, for the committee to understand why that would be and how we have privacy related to filers, and why that number, when Representative Rukavina tries to get 50, why it moves around. Ms. Manzi, if you could just tell us why he can't always get the exact 50.
Madam Chair, this has to do with the break point that I picked when I asked the Department of Revenue for this estimate. And the department, I'll talk a little bit about our income tax sample and income tax model. Every year, the Department of Revenue prepares a sample of roughly 20,000 income tax returns, and it's a stratified random sample by income ranges, different filer types, and it includes part year and non-residents. At the very high end, this sample includes all the returns in the very top strata, and the sample then gets used with an income tax model, which we maintain in the House, but which is shared with the Senate, the Department of Finance, and the Department of Revenue. It's used for the forecast, and it's used to provide the revenue estimates that you'll see here in committee. In order for the Department of Revenue to adequately protect the confidentiality of those very high income taxpayers who are all included in the version of the sample that they prepare, the version that they share with us and with the Senate and even with the Department of Finance has the records in that top strata averaged every three records. So we get a higher weight for the records in the top strata, and we get fewer records. When Representative Rukavina asks me to get him information on the top 50 taxpayers, then what I do is I use our version of the sample to estimate what the income breakpoint is for those top 50 taxpayers, and then I send that request to the Department of Revenue. However, when they do it with their sample, which is going to be more accurate and from which they can give me aggregate results, they just can't give me the detail on those top taxpayers, it sometimes ends up being 55 taxpayers or 48 taxpayers or 57 taxpayers.
Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Representative Broad.
Madam Chair, just before we move on, I was just, the last session we had a number of our members running for Congress, and with the discussion of the federal tax law and Social Security, Representative Rukavina, I'm just wondering if you're making an announcement that is going to put us in the same position going into the next session.
Madam Chair, I'd like to announce my exploratory bid for president.
Thank you. You heard it here first, members. You heard it here first. Representative Mullery.
I'm wondering if Representative Broad forgot that I thought we had Rukavina for Senate buttons last time.
Ah, yes, yes.
Whatever.
Other questions? If not, Ms. Manby, what page are we on now?
Madam Chair, during this discussion, Ms. Templin has found for me the estimate that Representative Rukavina asked about back at the start, so I can share that with the community now. If the income tax rates were returned to their 1998 levels, and this is an estimate that was done off of the February 2006 forecast, so it would be a little bit different if we update it to November. The revenue gain would be roughly $900 million per tax year, and that would fall out a little bit heavier in the first fiscal year, but then it would level out at around $900 million per fiscal year going forward.
Thank you, Ms. Manzi. I expect we're going to hear that figure a number of times in this committee for the rest of the session. I appreciate that Representative Rukavina brought that forward. Representative Colt.
Madam Chair, Ms. Manzi, could you remind me, and maybe you stated this earlier, I want to jot it down, though, what were the tax brackets back in 98 before the change was made?
Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, Representative Colt, the rates in 1998 were 6%, 8%, and 8.5%. The brackets would have been somewhat lower than what they are now because we didn't change the brackets then. We just continued to index the brackets annually for inflation. So we just reduced the rates, and we reduced them in two steps. The biggest part of the reduction occurred for tax year 99, and then they came down a little bit more in tax year 2000.
Thank you.
Ms. Manzi.
Whoops. Back. Okay. Moving on to the three non-refundable credits that Minnesota has, we have a what we call a marriage penalty credit, a credit for taxes paid to other states, and a long-term care credit. So these credits can only be used to offset your actual liability. That's the non-refundable part. The marriage penalty credit was enacted in 1999 as part of the rate reduction, and this is... It has a similar result with regard to earned income for the system that Mr. Michael was describing with the two columns where each spouse would enter each component of their income separately. This credit only applies to wages, taxable pension income, and taxable Social Security income. When this was implemented, the thinking was that other kinds of unearned income would be more easy for spouses to sort of game the system and allocate evenly between themselves in order to maximize this credit. So this credit is only offsetting the marriage penalty that is in Minnesota's rate and bracket system resulting from earned income. There's a table where you look this up in the income tax return, or if you use software, the software will calculate it for you. It's based on what the earnings of the lesser earning spouse in a couple are and what the total income of the couple is. The more equally earnings are split between the two spouses in the couple, then the larger the credit is. And the maximum credit in 2007 is $325. And this is estimated to cost about $60 million in fiscal 2007. The estimate for this particular item was taken from the tax expenditure budget that Mr. Michael referenced earlier. And then the Department of Revenue, since we've already talked about the income tax model, the Department of Revenue in part uses the income tax model to prepare that estimate. So that's how all these things interact. We also have a long-term care insurance credit, and this equals 25% of premiums paid for long-term care insurance up to $100, and it's $200 for married couples. This credit will cost about $8.4 million in fiscal year 2007. And the other non-refundable credit is a credit for taxes paid to other states. And that's a feature that many states with an income tax have, in which if you live for part of the year in one state and part of the year in another state, you figure your tax in each state based on your total income, and then each state allows you to claim a credit for the amount of tax that you had to pay to the other state so that you aren't really being double taxed there. Now we're up to 5 refundable credits. 2 of these were enacted last session. The largest is the Working Family Credit, which is the state version of the Earned Income Tax Credit. I think there are about 25 or 26 states that have these state Earned Income Tax Credits. These are a wage supplement in a way for low-income households. The credit equals a percentage of a household's earned income. So if you don't work, you don't get this credit. The maximum credit in tax year 2007 will be just over $1,600 for households with 2 children, and then it drops down to only $100 for households without children. And the brackets, the earnings brackets that are used to calculate this credit are adjusted annually for inflation, so it rises a little bit each year. Let's see what else I have about it. Yep, the maximum income eligible is just under $40,000 in 2007, and those parameters are also adjusted for inflation, so it keeps going up. Back when this credit was enacted in, I think, 1990, it was only allowed for households with incomes around $30,000, so it has gone up through inflation to close to $40,000 since then. It'll start phasing out, I think, when income is around $15,000 and then phase out gradually until you reach the maximum income eligible. The total cost in fiscal 07 is $138.3 million, so this is a rather substantial credit. Nationally, the federal earned income credit and the state earned income credits combined rival in size TANF and whatever the state equivalent is. In Minnesota, it's MFIP. So they really rival the size of welfare programs, but they are based totally on earnings. The average credit at the state level in Minnesota in 2004, which is the last year for which we have actual data, is just over $500, and there are around 250,000 Minnesota households who claim this credit.
Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Manzi, I know on the federal level there's often concern that that not everyone eligible for the EITC on that level is taking advantage of it. And I'm wondering if there's any understanding in Minnesota on the number of claimants versus the number of households eligible.
Ms. Manzi, may I just say something first, Representative Dabney? I actually was reading about this just recently and spoke with Ms. Manzi and was happy to learn that Minnesota, if I understand correctly, is doing about the best job of most states of making sure people are aware of this through hiring interpreters, through education programs with the Department of Revenue. If Ms. Manzi can comment further, I was looking at ways actually to see if we couldn't enhance the system and was happy to learn that Minnesota has done very well in this regard. So, Ms. Manzi, if you could add more where we rank in the nation and to Representative Dabney's question.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I don't know our national ranking off the top of my head, but I know that we have made a substantial effort at the state level to do outreach to taxpayers. The department coordinates and trains volunteer tax preparers who are available throughout the state. I think one of the areas where we're maybe a little weak is that the volunteer tax preparation sites are more prevalent in the metro area than they are in the rest of Minnesota. There are people in some parts of Minnesota that may have to travel a significant distance to get to a free tax preparation site. So we may, you know, if we were able to study this and find the people who weren't claiming the credit, we might find that more of them were in rural areas than in the metro area. There also have been some efforts with the Department of Human Services to encourage caseworkers to advise clients to claim the credit if they have any earnings. Most of the people who receive welfare benefits are subject to a work requirement, so they should have some earnings, but they may not have enough earnings to meet the filing requirement either at the federal or the state level, by virtue of having very low earnings and maybe working in a part-time job to start out with. So I think that's an area where people may tend to fall through the cracks. And has Don done work on that? Yeah, Don Hirasuna of our office does economics research, and he has done some work on that topic, so I may be able to find some background information that he's prepared on that for you and for the committee.
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Ms. Manzi.
our second largest refundable credit is the K-12 education credit, and this credit equals 75% of eligible K-12 expenses. This includes amounts paid to others for transportation, amounts paid for tutoring, for after-school academic enrichment programs, for academic summer camps, and for textbooks if the parents of the student are required to purchase the textbook. This credit is also subject to an income-based phase-out. Like the working family credit, it phases out right around at $40,000 of income. The phase-out for this credit starts at $33,000, and how far it goes depends on how many kids you have in your family who are in grades K through 12. It extends $2,000 above that if you have, no, it extends $4,000 above that if you have one or two kids in grades K through 12, and then it goes an additional $2,000 for each additional child that you have in grades K through 12, and that's a new change that was enacted, I think, just last session. The maximum credit under this equals $1,000 per child. So if you have four children in grades K through 12 and you're income eligible, you could claim a credit for up to $4,000. That would be 75% of your expenses, so you would be making expenditures at, let me see, something over $5,000. I'm not going to do the math to get that quite right. The parameters for this credit, unlike the working family credit, are not adjusted annually for inflation, so that phase out is always going to start at $33,500, and the maximum credit is fixed at $1,000 per child. Oh, here's the list of eligible expenses. Okay, tutoring, academic books, music lessons, and up to $200 in computer software and hardware. Total amount estimated for fiscal year 2007 is $15.4 million. The average in 2004 was about $250 with about 60,000 claimants. This is about the K-12 deduction, which sort of parallels the credit. The difference is that the deduction is allowed for non-public school tuition. The maximum deduction is $2,500 for students in grades 7 through 12 and $1,625 for grades K through 6. The deduction would typically be claimed by households with incomes over the income limit for the credit. So there's always going to be a tax preference for you for K-12 education expenses, whether you're low income or not. Because if your income is too high for the credit, you can claim this deduction. Our third refundable credit, and for a long time these were the three that we had, is the dependent care credit, and this is tied to the federal dependent care credit. It's set as a percentage of actual child care expenses up to a maximum. The maximum is $720 for one child and $1,440 for two or more children. Like the other two credits I've discussed, this one is also subject to an income-based phase-out, which is in more or less the same income range as the other two. For the dependent care credit, the phase-out starts at just over $20,000, and it ends at around $35,000. And this phase-out is indexed annually for inflation, so it also has been going up through the years. This credit is going to cost the state about $12 million in fiscal 07. The average in 2004 was about $350, about 35,000 claimants. This is the smallest of the three credits, both in terms of dollar amount and in terms of number of claimants. We have two new refundable credits. The military service credit was enacted last year, and this is going to provide $59 on refundable credit for each month that an individual has served in a combat zone since September 11th of 2001. In 2006, eligible people will be able to claim a catch-up going all the way back to 2001. If an individual was killed in a combat zone, then the surviving spouse or dependent child may claim the credit going back for those years. We had a little drafting oversight, which the department is going to propose to remedy in their bill, where we didn't allow for people who died somewhere other than in a combat zone since 2001, they're going to propose allowing the estate or the surviving spouse to go back and get that credit for the past months of service for those individuals. This credit is going to equal, it's going to be a big amount in the first year because we're catching up for the past years, $8 million in 07, and then it's estimated to be just over $2 million in following years. There'll be 12,000 claimants in 2006, and then that is estimated to drop to about 3,400 in future years and level out there.
Whoa.
And I'll just briefly mention we have one other refundable credit that was enacted last year. It's a credit for testing for bovine tuberculosis. Minnesota, we found bovine tuberculosis in Minnesota in 2005, and we now have to test all of the feeder calves that are shipped out of state. So this credit is a 50% credit that is going to help people raise beef cattle to pay for this testing that's required before they can sell their cattle out of state. The department, I believe, is also going to propose in this bill to sunset the bovine testing credit once Minnesota is once again declared a bovine tuberculosis-free state, which they expect will happen sometime in the next year or so.
Thank you, Ms. Manzi. We're going to move to the sales tax in a moment, but first, members who have further questions on anything raised in the income tax area that's been raised today or anything that you think's been missed and you need to know something about it, but first Representative Colt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Manzi, Representative Rukavina mentioned progressivity during the previous exchange, and one of the things is I'm trying to get some information. I'd like to get some information either now or if you could follow up with me. I'm curious the number of Minnesota filers who have either zero tax liability or negative tax liability because of the refundable credits. If you have the ability to get me that. And then I'm also I'm interested if it's possible to construct, I don't know, the average family to the extent we can do that. I'd like to know if somebody takes full advantage of all of the credits, the deductions, et cetera, at what point, at what income level do they pay or do they become do they get into the tax system where they actually have tax liability? You mentioned a $20,000 figure before, but I'm not sure that people below $20,000 aren't really in the system. Does that number include taking full advantage of the various credits, and if not, could you construct something so that I could at least understand kind of where that break happens?
Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, I can get those numbers for you as to how many people there are, and actually we can, I think, have an estimate of the number of households in Minnesota that are outside the income tax system entirely. As for the credits, I'll probably prepare that to show you the income breakpoint where they would actually start having liability if they had any one of those credits or all three of those credits. I think Department of Revenue data have shown that there's really very few households that claim all three of those credits, which makes sense when you think about it, because a household is maybe only going to, for a few years, have both dependent care expenses and K-12 education expenses. So they'll maybe move from having one to the other. And the other thing that goes on with those two credits is that the households don't always have the K-12 credit in particular, they don't always have the resources to make the expenditure in order to later claim the credit. So but I can prepare that information for you.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Cole, that's a good question. And Ms. Manzi, thinking about Representative Cole's question, and if you could provide that to the full committee, one thing I've always been interested along that same line is sort of the generational bubble that moves through. And my understanding is it's really, families with lots of kids that really kind of bear the biggest burdens and then therefore have some of these credits available to them. And then, of course, when you're, move into retirement, you don't even pay the income tax, so you're off the system completely. But if you can also add for members to think about how, as you move through time, as you age, kind of where you are in the tax system, and because that's part of the calculation, too, is those lower groups that aren't in the income system tend, I think, to be large families, the poor, and seniors. And it depends really how you're counting income that we certainly know that there would be people not paying income taxes but aren't quite well situated, at least financially. So, Representative Cole.
Well, Madam Chair, I would note that I certainly have a lot of constituents, I'm sure everybody around the table do, who are seniors and not working but certainly have income tax liability because of investment income, IRA income, whatever it might be. So while it's true that as people leave the workforce, their taxable income in many cases does decrease, that's not to say they completely get outside of the income tax system.
That's right. Thank you, Representative. Other questions from members on income tax before we move to sales? If not, Ms. Manzi, Representative Mallory.
Madam Chair, just I think it was Representative Coles that brought up constituents. I was just thinking last fall, and I'll leave the names of parties out of this. I was at a neighborhood just dinner, and one guy told me that he never voted for my party because he made $23,500 in family income and had three kids, and we took all of his income in taxes. Is that what would he be paying in taxes?
Madam Chair, Representative Mallory, I can't give you the precise amount that he was paying. If he was married and had a spouse,
he's married,
then he would not be paying, should not be paying state income taxes with those three dependents. His standard deduction and exemptions should be greater than the $23,500. A lot of people tend to confuse things at the state and federal level. So he may be concerned about his Social Security withholding or the level of sales taxes that he pays or his property taxes. There may be a lot of other things that he could be talking about, but I don't think that, given the information you provided there, that he shouldn't have any state
tax liability. It was just
income
taxes. Thanks.
Other questions? If not, thank you, Ms. Manzi. I guess this has given you a lot of assignments for information during your presentation. We look forward to that. And I think sales tax, we're going to Ms. Templin.
Okay. Madam Chair, in my introduction, I forgot to mention that I will also be covering the first four slides of sales tax revenue, and Pat Dalton will be covering the rest of the sales tax presentation. On slide 31, sales tax revenue, as I mentioned in one of the earlier slides, $5.1 billion is projected in sales tax revenue for fiscal 2007. Of that amount, $513 million comes from the motor vehicle sales tax. And again, as I mentioned earlier, this sales tax revenue is roughly 30% of state tax revenues. All of sales tax revenue goes to the general fund except for motor vehicle sales tax. Roughly $275 million goes to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, Transit Fund, and Highway Funds. And lottery and lieu payments, roughly $20 million goes to the Game and Fish Fund and the Natural Resources Fund. And businesses pay about 44% of the sales tax, and this information comes from the incident study prepared by the department.
If I may stop you, Representative Wheeling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just if I may, could you just explain for those of us who are new to this what lottery and lieu payments are?
Ms. Templin.
Madam Chair and Representative, lottery and lieu payments, that is where the lottery is, they don't pay sales tax. They pay a rate equal to 6.5% times the gross receipts of lottery revenues. And that is the, and that's a short description of it, and I think it will be covered in greater detail by Ms. Dalton.
And Ms. Templin, Representative Liebling, I think maybe Mr. Michael can nod if I'm right on this and correct me if I'm wrong. In one way to think about it, if someone has to go in and buy a dollar lottery ticket, do we want them to pay $1.06, or do we want to incorporate that tax into the cost of the ticket for ease of administration? Is that the reason that it was constructed that way originally, Mr. Michael? That's how I'd always heard it explained.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that's a fair characterization. There's there was another element to it at the time that this was implemented, in that the lottery was a portion of the lottery revenues by the Constitution were dedicated. And so if you had just exempted the lottery sales from the sales tax, you know, that dedication would apply to all the lottery revenues. At the time, the legislature said, well, these are sales that would normally be subject to the sales tax. If you, you know, buy anything else, it's subject to the sales tax. And so by imposing this in lieu tax, it diverted that money to the general fund without regard to the percentage dedication. Subsequently, some of that has been dedicated by statute, and so that sort of nullified that initial decision, but that was the other element that wasn't.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Representative Liebling, did you have further questions?
That's fine, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Templin.
32 shows sales, the growth, or the 10-year history of sales tax revenue growth from 1997 projected to 2007. And you can see in 1997, in actual dollars, $3.3 billion was received by the state, and $4.2 billion in constant dollars was received by the state in sales tax revenue. And I believe the dip in 1999 is the sales tax rebate. And in contrast to the chart that we saw earlier on income tax revenues, this line chart doesn't appear to mimic the economic fluctuations like individual income tax does. So, a little different. Moving on to slide 33. Again, we see another slide, effective tax rates, and this is just for sales taxes. And again, the effective tax rate is the ratio of taxes paid or sales taxes paid relative to income. And again, this slide shows the distribution of sales tax burden on Minnesota households. And this chart shows, again, the consumer purchases and business purchases and by quintile. And again, the lower the percent, the lower the tax burden.
Ms. Templin, if I may stop you, Representative De La Forest.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Question from Ms. Templin. I would assume that the slides here do not incorporate any of the local sales taxes in the 21 cities and 2 counties where it currently exists. True?
Madam Chair, Representative, this does include state and local sales tax.
Okay, it does.
Ms. Templin, and I'm interested in that as well, Representative De La Forest, what is the lag time for when we get these numbers? As we know, we're going to see these numbers again in March. So to Representative De La Forest's question, how long, for example, if a tax started January of 07, a local option sales, how long will it take us to see on the Minnesota Tax Incident Report? Is that a one-year cycle or a two-year cycle before we actually see that play out? I see we're looking at the Department of Revenue here, and maybe someone can tell us, because I think Representative De La Forest is right. I mean, this committee has spent a lot of time thinking about these local option sales taxes, and there is a lag before we actually see the burden falling on people as to when we get these numbers. So some of the newer, more controversial taxes that are in place, Representative De La Forest, I don't think are in here.
That's right, Madam Chair, and if you'll bear with me, I did have a couple other questions with respect to the sales tax, but my point is to you, Madam Chair, and to my colleagues on the committee, that this chart demonstrates, and we know empirically, that this is a very regressive style tax, yet one of the great inconsistencies of this committee and this body is that we embrace progressivity, allegedly, yet there is a proliferation of these taxes, it seems, time and again, including this session. So I hope we bear that in mind as we debate local option sales taxes and metro-wide sales taxes and the like.
Thank you, Representative De La Forest. I think we've got some information for you, too, and I'm looking at Representative Marquardt, who I know is going to hear local option sales tax bills this year, and Representative De La Forest knows that he and I think alike on this. This committee is all over the map and will continue to be, but I think it is important, and we should get some information as to how we can stay on top of what we're doing as we're moving toward a more regressive system when we're offloading things onto the sales tax. Ms. Templin. Or was it Mr. Michael? Someone got some information. Representative De La Forest.
Madam Chair, Representative De La Forest, we don't have the answer. What we do know is that the data that will be used in the new study is 2004 data. And The Department of Revenue, in analyzing that data, uses the current law, the latest law. But what we're not sure on is this precise question about whether they try to simulate the effect of the local sales taxes in using current law. We'll have to check with Paul Wilson and find out whether they do that or not.
Representative DeLaForest.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And another question I had, shifting gears slightly, is there is a lot of talk philosophically, Madam Chair, about broadening the sales tax. And I'm wondering if anyone has done any modeling to see if a broadening of the sales tax would make the system overall more regressive or less regressive, and how so. Has anybody done any work on that?
Representative DeLaForest, I'll ask Mr. Michael to answer that question. I don't know if the department wants to come down. I do know that, you know, there are certain pieces that would definitely make the system significantly more regressive, like adding food or fuel. Others that would make it more progressive. I think the clothing tax is one that would actually make the system a little more progressive. There's some service, high-end services that aren't being taxed, but I don't know if there's been any modeling. Mr. Michael, can you respond, or if Mr. Manson wants to tell us what the department's worked on? Mr. Michael?
We in-house research 20 years ago.
20 years ago, okay.
In 1987, did a comprehensive study of most of the personal consumption expenditures and the effects on incidents. And that's available. I don't, you know, much of this doesn't change a lot from year to year. No, that's pretty old. The Department of Revenue has, as part of the incident study and a couple of other things, has analyzed a few individual items much more recently than that, like in the late 90s, on clothing and a few of the other items, but nothing done comprehensively, I think. But there's some more data from DOR that's a little more current than that.
And Mr. Michael, I see Representative Solberg has a question on this as well. I do think it would be interesting to know what the Department of Revenue could find for Representative DeLaForest as to what's still around from Governor Ventura. In fact, the Ventura administration spent a great deal of time on this. I was actually looking at Governor Ventura's tax recommendations yesterday in the sales tax area, and I've got the book on my desk, and if you'd like to see it, it's, you know, this thick. That what came before the tax committee, that was when I was a freshman, I remember that. But Mr. Manson is coming down. Mr. Manson, did you want to join us at the table and answer Representative DeLaForest? Because, you know, hearing that a formal study is 20 years old is pretty significant.
Madam Chair and Representative DeLaForest, the last, I think, analysis we've done is related to the property tax reform that Governor Ventura put forward, where you really broadened the base to a lot of services. And I think that's the last time we did a comprehensive look at it, but it might be something that we can talk about a little bit about when we do our incident study to the committee, and I'll ask Dr. Wilson to kind of talk a little bit about it at that time.
That'd be great. Representative DeLaForest.
I was just going to say, Madam Chair, I did have just one more question, and
yes.
I thank you for your patience. I'm a bit troubled by this. It seems that, as I said, there's a lot of talk here and some momentum regarding the sales tax in various forms. Yet I'm surprised by how little modeling and empirical data we really have to underpin these proposals. So I'm glad to hear that certainly you will demand some empirical data for this committee to consider along with these proposals. But I did just have one final question about broadening the sales tax. I don't know, maybe Mr. Michael is my default, by the way, so I'll ask him for everything. Would broadening the sales tax really make for a more stable type of income for the government? I know a lot of people talk about we need stable income sources for government, and I'm wondering what your opinion is, Mr. Michael.
Thank you. Representative DeLaForest, Mr. Michael, you are all of our defaults, I think. I think we all know that. It's a big burden. We appreciate it. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative DeLaForest, at the same time we did the 1987 study on incidents, we also did a study on the stability effects of expanding the sales tax base. Because there was a lot of sort of conventional wisdom out there that expanding the sales tax to more types of purchases would make the revenue flows from the tax more stable. And it's been a long time since I've looked at that study, but I think if I recall it correctly, the basic answer is that that's sort of the conventional wisdom is not very correct. Food at home purchases are very stable. The rest of the expansions would sort of mirror the existing sales tax base. And so viewing the sales tax in isolation, the revenue flows from the sales tax, unless you expand it to food and medical care or home heating fuels. If you don't do that, you're not going to make the overall tax flows more stable. But here's the big but is if you get into tax substitution, our two taxes that are not very stable are, first of all, the corporate franchise tax. That tax, and we'll get into that later, oscillates a lot because it depends upon corporate profits. And the portion of the income tax that's dependent upon capital gains fluctuates a lot. And so if you increase the sales tax and use that to reduce the corporate franchise tax or the tax on capital gains, you would get a lot more stable revenue flows for the state. The trade-off, obviously, and this is always what tax policy making is about, is you would lose a lot of progressivity because the income tax on capital gains is a progressive tax. So you get revenues that are more reliable and predictable for the state, but you'd have a less progressive tax system by making that trade-off. But I think focusing only on the sales tax, if you were going to do a revenue-neutral sales tax reform and you don't tax food at home, which very few people ever talk about, or medical care, which nobody talks about, or home heating fuels, which maybe some people talk about, you're not going to make the tax revenues more stable. Now, you may make them more elastic in the sense that more expenditures are shifting to services, and so the taxes may keep better pace with the economy, which is another sort of, you know, revenue adequacy principle. But the stability, probably not much benefit.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels. Does that answer?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We're going to hear Representative Holbrook going to pass. What we're going to do instead is we're going to stop, we're going to adjourn, we're going to have lunch. I would ask all members, save this information in your save folder there so our pages don't throw it away. We'll pick up where we left off, and I thank everybody for the attention. Meeting's adjourned.